Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Nick Martin of the New Republic joins me to discuss the epidemic of abandoned oil wells throughout the United States, how they became so ubiquitous, what Democrats plan to do about them, and where they succeed and fall short.
And Heather Digby Parton will be here to help me run down the biggest stories of the week. Hey, become a member of this podcast over at ROFpodcast.com. It is your support that helps keep the show going. And this week, I've got a bonus interview with Stephen Wertheim. He is a fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft about Joe Biden pulling out of Afghanistan. You can check that out today. Meanwhile, here to help me break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and the popular blog Hullabaloo.
I tried to do handstands for you. I tried to do headstands for you. Every time I fell on you, yeah.
So, Heather, here we are. It is Joe Biden's, 101st day. Speaking on Friday, the 30th. And for whatever reason, we have decided as a country is 100 days is a good round number to assess the presidency. Frankly, I don't think we have enough time. I think we need a little more time to assess what's going on. Certainly, the narrative has changed since the heady days of the COVID relief bill that was passed in, you know, sort of very direct path, it seemed like. I mean, you had to go through reconciliation, but there was, it was almost as if there was like very clear steps that were followed. We're going to invite some Republicans to the White House. We're going to listen to what they say. Everybody's going to have cookies and maybe some coffee or tea. And then they're going to say, we're not on board for any of this. And we say, okay, thank you very much. And we'll start the reconciliation process and we pass it. And that was it. It was very clean. Not so much with this round. There are two tranches, essentially, for the big infrastructure and jobs bills and family bills, both of which, when you tally them up, equal nearly $4 trillion. Joe Biden, two nights ago, announced what was going to be in the American Families Act. And let me just say, before we get your perspective, excuse me, the American Families Plan. Let me just say, before I get your perspective on this and we go through some of the details, kudos to Democrats for coming up with a very basic, wholesome sounding name for this plan, as opposed to like, well, we're going to call it the AFP or the ACR3 or something. This is very hard to attack a plan for American families. Heather, give me your sense. I don't know. I mean, let's divide this up. There's the rhetoric that was in the speech. There's the plan that was outlined. Then there's the issues around the sort of different components of the plan. And then there's the question as to whether it gets going to get passed. So maybe we should just start with the rhetoric, because I don't know about you, but that rhetoric was very different than what we've heard in a long time.
Well, I agree with that. I thought the rhetoric was really good. I mean, for a change, I felt like, you know, it was pretty straightforward. I thought it was very, appealing to people across all kinds of political lines. There was not a lot of jargon in it. You know, he wasn't, you know, using a lot of, you know, fancy language to describe things. And, the speech was well done. I mean, maybe it was the atmosphere without having the big crowd there, right, and it wasn't such a big deal. Maybe it's just him. He has a way, I think, of having a more intimate conversation than a lot of politicians. You know, he has his rhetorical style is very intimate. Maybe it worked better. I don't know. But it seemed to me like it was a successful outlining of an agenda in a way that isn't normally very successful, because it was a laundry list. I mean, let's face it. He laid out this plan for the American Families Act. I mean, he did all the other stuff too, talked about COVID and, you know, talked a little bit about foreign policy, not a lot, but, you know, mostly it was about laying out this plan. And, I thought he did it well. One thing I should say just before we move on, when you talk about the 100 days, I think that, just to let people know, it's tied into Roosevelt's first 100 days, that he did all of these big, big, big things in the first 100 days of his presidency. And ever since then, they've compared it to that. So that's what that's about. And really, we need the first 100 days is pretty irrelevant. Sometimes you get big things done. You come in with a crisis. Obama, he passed the stimulus plan. You know, Biden just passed the COVID relief plan. I mean, there are a lot of, it depends on what's happening when they first come into office as to how quickly things get done. When it's a crisis, they tend to get more things done more quickly. But it's the second 100 days that really makes the difference, because what happens is the opposition, and I think in this case, it was truly the case, they're off base. They don't quite know what to do. They're still kind of trying to find their sea legs in this new environment. And so in the first 100 days, they often are not really able to mount a very effective opposition. It's the second 100 days when they finally decide how they're going to do it. And I think we know how they're going to do it. Right. There's not a big secret there. In fact, they've already signaled that. But that's really what that 100 days is about. And I think that Biden's been pretty good. And you have to give him a little bit of leeway here, because he had no real transition. You know, they didn't do the transition as normal. So they didn't have time or the ability to get in there and kind of get the place staffed and ready and, you know, get it ready to go. I'm not trying to make excuses, because I think the COVID relief plan was pretty successful. But nonetheless, you know, the fact is that they are trying, I think, to hit the ground running. And I do not know how successful that's going to be in the second 100 days, because I think we're already seeing all the.
Well, before we get there, I just want to say, like, in terms of the rhetoric, what I found interesting, there was some mention of pay for, which we will get to, which is a problem. Right. But there was also a promotion of unions.
Yeah.
It was weird to see a president promote unions as president when he did when he mentioned Alabama, referenced the Amazon strike, I should say unionization drive in Bessemer that failed. But he mentioned unions. He also said trickle down economics is dead. Mm-hmm. The idea that we need to the implication that we need to spend. I mean, here's the one thing, and maybe I'm putting too much into this at this point, but I remember when Barack Obama as a candidate said that he admired what Ronald Reagan did to the country. and there was a lot of different interpretations about what that meant. Mm-hmm. The interpretation at that time that I was hoping for, and I think you were hoping for, was that, because having lived through that transformation that Reagan did, yep. Many people say it was a political realignment in that 1980 election, or 84 election, I think it was the genuine realignment that, if I remember, the idea was that it was an era when the American public began to see government as a problem and an obstacle. And that was carried through. Even during the Clinton administration, wasn't as sort of direct, but there was this notion of, like, we're going to get government out of the way. We're going to make it leaner and meaner. And then there was a sense that maybe Obama is going to come in and reorient people's perspective towards government. They did the stimulus, but the stimulus was a significant portion of it was tax cuts, mm-hmm. right? As opposed to government coming out there and spending. You look at his signature achievement. What did they push? They didn't push the Medicaid part, which is government coming in, providing insurance for people, which incidentally, had we not had any Republican governors, would be covering far more people, not far more, but more people. And actually maybe more people at this point than the exchanges that were set up. Mm-hmm. That was the ACA part of it. And that was just, we're going to pay private insurance to deliver your insurance. We're just going to pay them. And so your cost is going to be lower, but we're going to pay them. Government's role is really only changing. Like, we're just footing a bill. We're privatizing this. And Biden, in both his plan and the rhetoric, and I almost consider the plan to be rhetoric at this point, because I'm a little bit dubious, but we'll see, is reorienting the country in a way that I think many of us thought that Obama was going to do and certainly had the opportunity to do.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't. He just didn't. And it was a turn to deficit hawkery. It was a sort of a soft notion that government can function well, but he sort of like ran from that very quickly until maybe later in his administration. So I think that was important insofar as that, like, you know, you're tilling the ground, right? Mm-hmm. You're loosening up the ground. It's spring. This is a good metaphor. You're loosening up the ground. Then you got to plant the seeds and then you got to, you know, grow the seedlings and whatnot, but you're loosening the ground. On the same part, if we're talking about rhetoric, he also tilled the ground for the deficit, the pay for issue, which is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Even when he was chastising Trump's tax cuts, balloon the deficit. Well, so that brings us to the plan, and we can talk about the details of the plan, but I want like people just to know, like, I want to put a little tentpole there, because what's going on in Washington now is this weird, like, moving target of fight, both, you know, put aside the Republicans within the Democratic Party,
mm-hmm.
about the idea of the deficit, about the idea of pay for is about the idea of why you would have this taxation. All of those things sort of are like moving around in this weird sort of constellation. We don't even know, like, you know, some of them are like dark planets. We can't quite figure out where they are. And but we'll get to that. But let's just talk about the American Families Plan. The biggest disappointment, I think, is we don't see a real like plan to expand Medicare in any fashion, or a public option in the exchanges. Healthcare is a big part of families. There was a late entry of extending the ACA payments. We also have things like daycare and daycare and universal pre-K for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Great stuff. Expansion of that. 2-year free community college.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to see some debt relief as well, and maybe a 4-year free college in every state. We have Pell Grants and some support for HBCUs and minority serving institutions, expansion of summer meals program. ACA subsidies are extended, like I said, and they increased, it extends the increased child tax credit, $300 a month, essentially,
mm-hmm.
until 2025, which was clever because that puts it in the hands of the next administration, right? And those are the big sort of headlines from that. Called on Congress to pass the PRO Act, all of these things. And really, it comes down to President Joe Manchin in many respects. So let's take a brief break. And when we come back, let's talk about the state of the play of these things. I also want to get into just a brief look on what's happening on the Republican side. Not much. Although there are some people planting some seeds that we should watch out for, because these seeds are not ones that you want to, that are going to bear any fruit or vegetables that you're going to want to eat. So let's take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. So Heather, in the first segment, we basically just gave our thoughts as to the rhetoric of the speech and a quick run through of what's in the American Families Plan, which Joe Biden laid out for the American public. We knew more or less what was in it before then. Even now, a lot of the details are not quite clear. But let's talk about the state of play here, because the other part of the American Families Plan are some pretty significant tax increases, but on the wealthiest of Americans. We're seeing it in capital gains, which is, you know, just so that people understand, for reasons I'm sure everybody can imagine, in this country since the Reagan era. We basically treat money that has been earned by being wealthy as less taxable than money that is earned by actually working for it and being less wealthy. I mean, so people's money, when it earns money for them, is taxed at a less amount than people's labor. And that is completely messed up. There's some tweaks to that, you know, would tax people making that kind of money over, you know, $1 million or something. There are Democrats who are against that. Let's just put it Republicans are aside against all tax increases. There are Democrats who are against that because they don't want to tax the rich. There are Democrats who are for getting rid of the cap of the on the SALT deductions, which, again, most of the benefits go to the wealthiest of people, like 80% of the benefits go to the wealthiest people. Then there are other Democrats who are saying, we don't need the taxes because we don't need to pay for it. So there's this weird dynamic of some Democrats saying we don't need to pay for it, therefore we don't need the taxes. There's others who have an issue with the taxes. They don't want to raise taxes on the rich. There are others who think we need the taxes, not because we need to pay for it, but because we have a wealth inequality problem. And when you allow money to accrue that way, you have a wealth inequality problem. And then you have people like John Tester, who this week said, I don't want to raise taxes, but we got to pay for this. But I don't want to raise taxes. We really need to spend it. But I don't know, you know, like in that situation, it's sort of like, well, I want to go to Hawaii, but I don't want to fly. And I also get seasick. So, but I want to, I am determined to go to Hawaii. Well, okay. Good luck. And so what do you make of all this?
Well, yeah, that's very interesting that you, what you just said, because I hadn't actually thought of it in quite those terms, but I've been, you know, kind of wondering where they were going to go with this, because we're really dealing with two separate issues that people are trying to conflate, or they're moving back and forth between them. The idea that we don't need to pay for it is kind of, you know, this is you know, everybody from the MMT people on the one end to Paul Krugman in the New York Times are saying, look, we're dealing with a situation where we're looking at potentially a huge amount of growth here coming. We've just come out of this crisis. We've got a whole bunch of things that maybe we're going to be building if we pass this infrastructure bill, all of this. It is, you know, after World War II, they, you know, we grew our way out of whatever the debt was, however you want to, whether you want to look at it from the MMT side, which means it isn't debt, but or just the traditional way. But this is not a situation where you need to worry about paying for things. Money's extremely cheap. You want to borrow now. This is the time. Let's build some things. Let's make some jobs and whatever. So you have that group. And then you have this other group that's saying, well, you know, gee, we really need to pay for it. And Biden was a little confusing on this, I think, because by his, what you said earlier, that when he's talking about the deficit and, you know, exploding the deficit and that kind of stuff, he's kind of playing into that side. But in reality, by doing the infrastructure, proposing this big bill, that is not going to be, that is not really a pay for. I mean, that is, they're going to borrow money to do this stuff, as they should, as they absolutely should. So we're in this weird situation. I don't know whether, I mean, we know what the Republicans are going to say. Oh, they're exploding the deficit. And, you know, the fact that what they did under Trump, I mean, people will throw it in their faces, but they're shameless, so they don't care. And, you know, they'll just keep saying it, but forget them because they're not going to cooperate anyway. But within the Democratic Party, this is a hugely interesting and significant argument to be having, because if you want to, everybody's saying this morning, well, you know, the finally, they're turning back the Reagan, you know, legacy. We're moving on to, you know, government is back, et cetera, et cetera. Well, if that's the truth, then they have to start thinking about government differently than this idea of it being, you know, the green eye shades and sitting there with the, you know, with the accountants going over whether or not the debit and credit line. That just, that's not government. It's not what it's for. It's not a business. It's not a family budget. It is the government, and it has a completely different role in American life, in any life. And so they have to start thinking of it differently. So this argument is really pretty healthy, I think, because it's forcing people in the Democratic Party to start to come to terms with what it is they really believe about this. Now, I don't know who's going to win. And I think maybe Joe Biden may be one of those people who's kind of, you know, on the fence on this. He doesn't really know what he thinks. But, you know, if they want to do this thing, they've laid out this huge agenda. they're going to have to reckon with this because they're not going to tax their way out of it. They're not going to. They have to borrow money to do this thing. So I feel kind of optimistic in a weird way that they've kind of backed themselves into a corner, that they're going to have to at least reckon with it philosophically. Now, whether or not it can pass, I don't know, because President Manchin and Emperor Sinema and now Emperor Kelly, too, who's stepping up, you know, these people are going to decide for America what's going to happen, which is truly unfortunate and a topic for another conversation. But within the party itself, I think this is the first time I've heard any real kind of reckoning with the details of what it is that we've been talking about on this. So I'm hopeful. And by the way, the taxation that Biden is proposing, it is, the fact that anybody would care that people who are making over $500,000 a year have to kick in more money, I cannot grapple with that. This is just not, I mean, the old days, the Republicans used to make the argument that, well, they're the producers and, you know, they're not going to work as hard for you if we'd have to tax them. And this is just the most nonsensical thing in the world, considering the huge amount of profits they've been making in recent years and just in the last year. While everybody else is standing in food lines or basically treading water, the wealthy have been just, you know, raking it in. Their money's been making a lot of money for them. Right. So, you know, I can't believe that we have to even think about that as being a problem. Why any Democrat would think about it is beyond me.
Well, and I would also add that we could step in and we could take 90% of, you know, Elon Musk's and Jeff Bezos's wealth, never mind their income. We'd take their wealth. And guess what? Not going to make one whit of difference if they work anymore. In fact, I question how hard, you know, what kind of work they're doing that is having a societal benefit at this point, as opposed to when you have that kind of billions of dollars, there's really not much you need to do to make a ton of money at all.
Money makes money. And if you took 90% of Jeff Bezos's wealth, he'd still be one of the richest people in the world. I mean, you know, come on.
Let me ask you this question. We keep saying President Manchin, and then you mentioned Sinema and Kelly as well. Do you think that if Manchin signs on to anything, there is any room for Kelly or Sinema to go out and grandstand? There is this concept in Washington where, you know, certain people provide the margins. And if they do something, it gives others who are within the inside of those margins cover to do it too. And like, you know, well, if this is good enough for Joe Manchin, I'm certainly, it's good enough for me. And we should say Arizona is not West Virginia. And Joe Manchin's very difficult to figure out here. The real question is going to be like, you know, ultimately, is the White House willing to jettison, let's say, the tax increases to just get the spending? And I spoke to David Dayen on the Majority Report earlier this week. And he said he was encouraged by conversations with people in that orbit that they don't see those two elements, the tax cuts and the spending, linked inexorably. They feel that they can be separated and we could lose the tax raises. I happen to be of the mind that you spend while you get the chance.
Yeah,
and we desperately need to deal with wealth inequality in this country, but you're going to have more opportunities to deal with that later than you will to spend like these type of dollars, you know, that we're seeing now. Raising taxes on these billionaires and millionaires is not going to necessarily get you the votes in the fall of 2022, like,
of course,
spending and providing material benefits to people. I mean, I hope that's obvious to people. Like, you know, wealth inequality is a for voters anyways, I think they perceive as sort of like a an abstract concept.
Right.
But the fact is it does impact your daily lives. We just don't see it in the same way that we would if, like, we got a check in the mail to deal mm-hmm. with my kids. So that's where we're at. We're going to have, like, we're still in sort of like the incomplete status, but I do get the sense that you're right. The next 100 days, the next 3 months are going to basically tell the story of, frankly, of the Biden administration. Yeah. And we're going to know where they're leaning and the level of success. So let's take the next, we got about a couple more minutes to look just at the Republicans. Donald Trump's approval rating fading. He's not on Twitter. He's, you don't see him much except for in like this sort of conservative bubble. And you really, a lot of people are in that conservative bubble, mm-hmm. but still got to step outside of it a little bit to get some. That's not happening. So, I'm starting to see the stories like Mike Pence is checking to see if he can run for office. And those type of things. You wrote about Liz Cheney. And for those of us, who cut our teeth a decade or so ago, the Cheneys are are nauseating in some way. I don't know how else to put that. And lay out your thesis. And so we just alert people to go and check out your piece.
Well, I wrote about it for Salon. It was in yesterday's edition. But Liz Cheney is clearly setting herself up to run for president. She stepped out, from the very beginning. She's the queen of the Never Trumpers. She's the one who, she voted for impeachment in the second impeachment. She was, she's been upfront in saying that Donald Trump must be discredited and he must be drummed out of the party, basically. Now, I've always thought that someone would take that position. It's not unusual. It's not, why wouldn't they? It's a lane, if you want to use that stupid, term, that the political analysts use. It's a lane that is open for someone to take. I'm the anti-Trump. And, she being a woman, I think that there's some thought that maybe nominating a woman for the Republicans. I've always thought it was possible that the first woman president could be a Republican if it was the right one. I think she may think she is. So she's clearly setting herself up to run for president and setting herself up as an arguing against the the weak-willed Republican men who won't stand up to Donald Trump. Okay, fine. The problem is, and a lot of people are giving her credit and everybody's going, Liz Cheney, she's the only one with integrity, et cetera, et cetera. And I started to feel a little nauseated by that because we do not want Liz Cheney to be president. And anybody who is a Democrat or a liberal, progressive, socialist, whatever you are, think twice and go back and look at her and see what she's doing this as a strategy. I don't even care if she believes it doesn't matter. It's a strategy and her record is terrible and she is her daddy's daughter. And don't forget who he was because we have Iraq and Afghanistan to thank.
Yep.
Thank Cheney for.
Folks should check out your piece at salon.com. Lays it out there for those, particularly you youngins who are not familiar with the Cheney legacy. Heather Parton, always a pleasure. We will talk again next week.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Heather Parton is a weekly contributor to Ring of Fire Radio. You can find her writings over at salon.com and the Uber blog, Hullabaloo. Now, my colleague, Emma Viglin. Emma, what do you have for us this week?
Thanks, Sam. As Democrats begin to address climate change, an under-discussed issue that has been gaining some attention more recently is orphaned, abandoned oil wells, which are leaking methane fumes and contaminating groundwater throughout the United States. And it's even worse than previously thought. Here to break down all of that is Nick Martin, staff writer at The New Republic. Welcome, Nick. Thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a huge issue. You write particularly in West Virginia and I guess New Mexico, but there are multiple other states that have this problem, Oklahoma and the city of Los Angeles, specifically you cite. We'll get into those different examples as we go along. But break this down from a 30,000 foot view, basically what the issue is, and then we will dive deeper.
Yeah, absolutely. So over the past century, as the United States has kind of, I guess, taken on various stages of interest in having domestic energy production that has obviously, as we now know, has leaned heavily towards both coal mining and then also, you know, more recently, the fracking for natural gas. And as all of these, and as well as oil. So as we've kind of, or industries have kind of pursued this at an incredibly rapid rate, we never, both in, when I say we, I mean like the federal government that is, you know, purportedly should be regulating and overseeing these operations, never really truly took into account what happens when a well kind of runs dry or when it's just completely abandoned for, you know, whether it's financial reasons or others. And so what we're kind of left with to contend, what we're left to contend with now is a situation where we have millions of abandoned and orphaned wells, and the both the methane emissions as well as the runoff. We don't have to get too deep into it, but basically, there's like there can oftentimes be kind of a briny kind of runoff that can get into groundwater and make it for the folks who either live on the property or live nearby the property. It can contaminate their well water and their and as well as any animals that depend on the water in the area. So, both in terms of emissions as well, you know, I think it was McGill University, you know, completed a study that found that these abandoned and orphaned wells account for something, I think they rank 10th in terms of overall anthropogenic methane emissions in just in general in the United States, which is an intense amount. And we're seeing similar rates in Canada as well. So that is the issue from 30,000 feet. What we are now tasked with as a nation and as a federal government and as state governments is to actively go in and complete a process which is known as plugging these wells. And that is kind of where we, you know, the entry point into this piece.
Right. And as we will get to later in our conversation, that is not so easy. So some of these stunning statistics that you cite, a 2018 Reuters piece that shows that the EPA knows of 3.2 million abandoned wells in the country, but that estimates show that there could be three times that. Now, you write that American corporations, energy companies, they've basically been able to drill wherever, whenever they think oil may be located. So is that what's contributed to this just immense amount of uncertainty about how many millions of these abandoned wells there are and the sheer number of them?
Yeah, I mean, especially in the past century, I think things maybe, I can't even say that because I was going to say maybe things have tightened up recently. But like the truth is that one of the Trump administration's parting gifts was granting a ton of new leases for, you know, new wells across the United States. So it's not a problem that has maybe slowed down or gotten particularly better. I think what we're kind of faced with now is, and it, like we're finally getting to a point where, you know, at least it seems like most of the, you know, Democratic power brokers in Congress are starting to recognize this as a widespread problem in need of a solution. Now, I mean, we can kind of go back and forth about what that solution should be. But yeah, I mean, you kind of summed it up well, saying that like we have just kind of wantonly, you know, drilled in pursuit of oil and natural gas and coal, and not left much, and not had much foresight in terms of like where that would leave us. And a big part of this that you kind of, you referenced with the Reuters, you know, study, which cited EPA data is, you know, this is something that, because it happens so often, so frequently, and these wells are kind of, just the tracking data over time has been really porous. And that includes, because also state agencies are supposed to, and we can kind of get into this maybe in a little bit, but like once a well is abandoned or orphaned, it ceases to be the financial, responsibility or have the liability tied to the company that actually did the drilling. It then shifts over to the state government, not the federal government. And that is kind of where we've had this massive problem, because even over the past decade, states have said like, this is a problem, we need to plug more wells, but it's like a lot of problems we kind of face in this country. It's like we recognize state budgets are limited. They don't have the abilities to do what the federal government should and could do. And so that's why we're kind of left at this juncture where, you know, the federal government is having to like backtrack and trying to backpedal and trying to say, oh, we need to throw billions of dollars at this problem so we can plug them. It is true. We have to do that. But the reason we got there was because of a lack of true oversight and concern for what, you know, just letting people drill all over would mean both for the environment and for the health of, you know, the communities that live near these wells.
Yeah. So just for the audience, so they understand the scope of the problem, according to a December 22 study by McGill Scientist University in Canada, the environmental science and technology, that area, abandoned and orphaned wells rank as the 10th highest source of anthropogenic methane emissions in the entire U.S. So this is really just because we allowed the oil industry to, if they had an idea of where to find oil in the country, all right, who cares, drill there. And yeah, we'll see what happens later. And you talked about the desire for the country to produce its own oil and not be dependent on foreign oil. That was really what was driving this kind of push. Is that correct? And when did this start? And when can you trace this back to this intense focus on domestic oil production?
I mean, it's kind of tough because I think you can trace it back as early as like the early 1900s. You're talking 1910, 1920s when you started to see oil booms across the U.S. And it's just kind of continued throughout. Now, obviously, like under the Bush and Obama administrations, we started to see more of a push to develop domestic, more wholesale domestic natural gas kind of energy production model. And, you know, I mean, we're sitting at an incredibly critical juncture as it relates to the climate crisis and what our emission standards and goals need to be. And those continually shift and will only become more drastic in what we need to cut as we continue to pursue this. So I think it's important to understand that, like, yeah, like these abandoned wells, they do make up an intense amount of a significant amount of the methane emissions in the U.S., but it's also more broadly, like you have to include these abandoned and orphaned wells and more broadly as in addition to like the natural gas pipelines and fracking operations that have been kind of fairly consistent for the past, 2021, I guess like 10 to 15 years. So so the answer is both long, it's got a long history, and then it also like has a very recent history in terms of the I think a renewed push to move away from dependency on foreign oil.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. And so we'll get into what the Biden administration and Democrats in the House at least are proposing in terms of a solution here. But I just want to focus on the lack of oversight of the oil industry. The oil industry has been subsidized by the federal government for decades, basically. And currently, as it stands now, as you write, the federal government only requires owners of wells and companies that own wells to show that they are actually operating those wells every 7 years. So they, as we have been repeatedly saying at the start of this interview, the oil companies can drill wherever they want, as long as they think oil could be there, as long as they think they can strike gold. And then they can abandon these wells, which when they abandon them, it falls on the states and the municipalities who often can't afford them. And then in terms of federal oversight, they only have to show that those wells are operating every 7 years. And then just break down for us how that during that time period, so many wells can spring up, so many wells can be abandoned, and then so many abandoned wells can contaminate the soil and the air.
Yeah. And I think, and this is maybe just more of a terminology thing, and I kind of stated it at the front of my article, just because as you kind of parse this nation, if you look as at what other nations are doing, everybody uses kind of different terms, but like just for, so the audience today can understand, an abandoned well is basically, it's one that is no longer operational, but it's still owned. You like it, you can prove ownership by a functioning company, a company that's still in business. An abandoned well becomes, orphaned when that company or that owner, you know, basically declares bankruptcy or otherwise just shuts down their operations and says, hands up, I'm not dealing with this anymore. You have to plug it. You being the state. And there's been a renewed push recently, I think, and within this legislation, and there will be, I think there will be, or there is a Senate a kind of companion bill that more or less tries to sort out or a similar solution. But basically it, what happens in the, between those 7 years is that once a well becomes defined as orphaned by a state government and the agencies that are supposed to oversee these, the state at least knows, right? It's like, this is a well we eventually have to plug. Even if like, and I cite this kind of in my piece where I'm talking about, you know, Oklahoma, like Oklahoma has, I think something like 800 wells that it wants to plug, and then 12,000 more that are orphaned.
Initial reporting by, and I said I'd say this.
That's right.
Emily Pontecorvo of Grist, who I was reading this piece. She was my camp counselor. Amazing. Shout out to Emily.
Yeah, incredibly small world stuff, yes. There, but in the best kind of way, honestly.
Yeah.
And as Emily reported, you know, in 2019, Oklahoma managed to plug, you know, 138 wells. So we're talking, they've got 800 more that they want to plug than 12,000 that kind of still need that attention. So like what I'm trying to get at here is the fact that even within that 7 year time span, you're seeing a ton of wells that actually should be categorized as orphan and should be scheduled for to be plugged that just aren't, it's not happening. And so by the time that 7 years is up, you're right. Like you said, it's like we've just had an explosion in terms of new wells that have, in terms of leases that have been granted by the Bureau of Land Management and other federal agencies that, you know, it just kind of is a cascading problem because nobody's ever just like hit the pause button and said, you know, wait, we need to kind of stop drilling. We need to just kind of get a better handle on closing up these orphaned wells, seeing which orphaned wells are actually, you know, maybe still operational, which ones need to be shut down. And also like a big part of this is also, we don't have accurate, you know, one, we don't, like I said earlier, we don't have accurate tracking data for the wells. We also like, just have not dedicated the amount of like R&D money to go to like tracking like actually how much methane is leaking into the air, because if we're just working off of estimates, you have to kind of, you know, you're only working with the data that you have available. So you can only, like as researchers and as they brought in one of the authors of that McGill study we cited it, you know, it's for this subcommittee hearing in the House last week, it is something where we just, you can't know what you don't know. And we are at a point where we know what the solution needs to be, but we really need to get a better grasp on what the scope of the problem that we're trying to solve is.
Yeah. And hopefully the Biden administration can get a grasp on that problem. When we come back, we will discuss the Biden administration's proposed solutions for this and where it falls short and where it's successful. We'll be right back. So when we went to break, we talked about how, yes, the scope of this problem of abandoned orphan oil wells is massive. But luckily, there's a Democrat in office, someone who may take climate change a little more seriously, maybe not as seriously as some progressives would like, including myself. But at least they're going to give this some consideration. The Biden administration and New Mexico Representative Teresa Fernandez have introduced the Orphaned Well Cleanup and Jobs Act. So can you break down what that is and how that would address the problem that we're discussing today?
Yeah, absolutely. So Representative Fernandez's bill, like I said earlier, so that is the House version. There's also in the Senate, I think it's something, it's like Revive Economic Growth and Reclaim Orphaned Wells Act, or I think they term it the Regrow Act. But that one's being introduced by Republican Kevin Cramer from North Dakota and Senator Ben Ray Lujan from New Mexico. So, but focusing on the House version, you know, what Representative Fernandez's bill would do, among many things, is it would try to, you know, one, it would shorten the length, that 7-year kind of check-in term that we mentioned earlier. It would shorten that down to 1 year. Also, what it would do is, so you would have to, as a company, you would have to prove, hey, I have this well and I'm actively using it. And you would have to check in with the federal government every year to ensure that you know, you can maintain your lease or permit on that land, which is supremely important to just kind of whittling down our current stockpile. I think what we have to do, what the bill also sets out to do, secondly, it's providing money to do what we were talking about earlier, which is identify, track, and then plug, and then eventually reclaim the wells that exist on federal lands. And then also what it would do is it would allow, or I think it actually, I think the language is that it would direct. So it would, if the bill's passed, the Interior Secretary currently, Deb Haaland, would then create a grant program so that state governments, as well as the governments of sovereign tribal nations, would be able to access this to, you know, kind of shore up their current programs for both tracking wells as well as plugging wells. And then I think it also, just more generally, there, again, like this is kind of getting into the wonky data, maybe like wonky policy side of it, but there's also like,
there are
bonds that companies, you know, and the governments agree to at this outset of some of these wells. And essentially, like what these bonds should pay for is in the event that the well runs dry or is, you know, just they decide not to operate anymore. It's basically what the bill introduces is a way for to ensure that all of, because ultimately, like if you think about it, like you don't want to end up in a place where we're spending billions of dollars to clean up the oil industry's mess, right? That's not to say the federal and state governments don't have culpability. They absolutely, like, they're the ones who have allowed all these wells to be drilled. But at the same time, these companies that drilled them and then just kind of left town after they ran dry, you want to hold a sense of financial liability there, of financial responsibility. And so I think what they're trying to do is kind of tighten the restrictions and regulations around those bonds to ensure that companies are actually going to pay up front for, you know, the costs that go into plugging a well, which is, you know, but it is costly and it is also very labor intensive, which is also kind of ties into the Biden administration's the American Jobs plan. Like the idea is that, you know, right now we have a very limited number of construction teams going around plugging wells. I think they're kind of advocating for this plan as well as a couple of other similar ones as being a kind of a job creator. So I think, you know, how in terms of how they pitch it politically, I would look out for that because that's kind of going to be their line moving forward. So I mean, you know, it's complicated, but at the same time, it at least, you know, both Fernandez's bill, the Senate companion, as well as the White House plan, I mean, I think they all at least move us in a general direction towards solving this problem. And then also, like, it's kind of like the student, like I think about this a lot in terms of the student loan issue, right? It's like, if you immediately relieve, you know, what, up to $50,000, let's say up to $75,000 in student loan debt that people, that US residents and citizens have, you're not really, like, you're addressing the problem, you're not fixing the problem, because the problem is a lack of public investment in education that requires people to rack up these enormous bills. So I think what we have here is, like, these are good solutions that don't just, you know, I think address the problem that's already exists, but it's also, they're also trying to tamp down and make it harder and more difficult for companies to go in, open up wells, abandon them, and kind of stick the rest of us with the bill.
Can you break down that process for plugging abandoned wells? Because as you mentioned, it's incredibly difficult. And, you know, we've seen pass, you know, under FDR, I believe, New Deal programs that you know, the government essentially created these jobs to do a public Environmental Service. It might have been the other Roosevelt. I'm blanking on this. I apologize. But so this could be a part of Biden's, I guess, you know, the shade of the New Deal that he's trying to implement. But the work is incredibly difficult. So can you break down why it's so labor intensive? And I just guess what it would
Yeah.
entail?
So just to give people an idea, basically when you drill down into the earth for oil and gas, what you do is you excavate down to, you know, however deep the pocket might be. And you lay in a pipe system, a pipe that, you know, effectively runs straight down to that pocket of oil or gas. And what you have to do to remove that, like, as you can imagine, like putting those into place is incredibly difficult. Removing those is incredibly difficult. So what you have to do, and NPR did a really good report kind of taking us through what it looks like for the people doing this work. But basically you need a team, you know, anywhere from a half dozen to 10 people. You use, your mechanical tools at your behest to rip the pipe out, infrastructures out of the earth. Then you have to, around the well itself, you have to set explosives to crack the rock. And in the resulting gaps, you pour in concrete and you seal the space. And then you have to kind of clean off the area that's closer to the soil and ground level. And eventually you have to, the idea would be that you can eventually come back and, you know, possibly it's reclaiming process is a little bit different, but you can potentially remove that because as we know, I also cite this in the piece, it's like, we're removing methane emissions there, but as you know, cement is a major driver of emissions as well. So you're kind of solving a problem with a different problem. So I think, you know, hopefully we'll be able to maybe, haven't seen any plans that kind of address that facet of it yet, but that is essentially the work that goes into it. And it does take I think the NPR folks said it took maybe 1 or 2 weeks for just one well. So, and when you're talking about millions, this is something that you do need tons and tons of workers, site managers, and all of that to kind of take on these projects, which it definitely exists, the ability there exists. And I think what these bills do is provide the financial capabilities for the states and the federal government to step in and actually facilitate some of the contracting work that would result from that.
So I think there can be the perception that this might affect just rural areas. I mean, at the top, I talked about West Virginia, New Mexico. This is co-sponsored by the Republican senator from North Dakota, right? Might just be when people picture an abandoned oil well or oil drilling site. Okay, it's going to be in the middle of the country. Wyoming is another state, Oklahoma. You also talk about how this has affected Los Angeles deeply. Can you explain what's happening there in terms of these abandoned oil sites?
Yeah. So in Los Angeles, for folks who have never been, you can see it outwardly, right? So you can, you see the oil kind of crank, like wells.
You see it when
away.
You're driving. You see it along the side of the highway, just the oil. It's like a pelican dipping its the water. I don't even know how to fully describe it.
Yeah. I mean, and it's just something where, you know, if you're not from a part, I'm from North Carolina, and we just it's just not a state that does a lot of natural gas or coal excavate, or actually it does do, it did do a decent amount of coal excavation, thanks to Duke Energy, but a different story. But Los Angeles, it is kind of it does kind of take you aback a little bit, because that is something you're more used to seeing in kind of rural landscape. So when you're driving through the city, you see this frequently, and the Los Angeles Times has done a lot of really great reporting, because also what happens is oil companies have basically bought they're real buildings, right? But they're completely hollow on the inside, and they house these wells. So it's it'll be in the middle of the city, and they're scattered all throughout the various neighborhoods in the city. What you're left with is
that, I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's to protect people from seeing the actual process.
I think it's basically
a liberal area, I guess.
I think so. I mean, it was a much more, you can look back at some really cool, cool in a kind of horrifying sense, but like some of the older archive photos of both at the Times and elsewhere, where they show you like this actually, it actually was way more blatant in like the 60s, 70s and 80s, where they just had them like out in the open. I don't know if it's just solely a political, or ideological thing where they're just trying to be like, oh, we're going to hide these wells from public sight. So, you know, people don't have to actively think about what we're doing to the environment around them all the time. But, whatever the causes of these infrastructures might be, the point is that they exist around like tons of communities in Los Angeles. And as of a few years ago, as the Los Angeles Times reported, and I cite in the piece, you know, the entire city only had one full-time well inspector working at the fire department to go around and check on all of these. So like what you're looking at, and like that's like basically a smaller, you know, kind of version of like what is this actual widespread problem, which is that, you know, local municipalities or state governments, they just don't have, I think it's both a matter of, they're not setting it as they for a long time. They just haven't made it an objective, a stated goal that we need to actually check and see how many idle wells exist. But now that it's happening, we're kind of taking stock of like, wow, the investment into like just regulating or an oversight on these has been porous, regardless, like if you're in a red state, red city, blue city, like it's just been something that's kind of been able to grow at an unprecedented rate for a very long time. And we're finally getting to a place where people are like, yeah, we need to like cut back on these. We actually need to start plugging them. So yeah, LA was like a super interesting case. And I really encourage people to go read the LA Times. They've done a lot of coverage around this. Their desk, their environmental and climate desk is really spectacular. So yeah, both on this issue and others, but yeah, on this particular topic, it was jarring for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, and quick, we have to run, but quick yes or no, are these oil wells largely in poor communities in Los Angeles? Communities of color?
I'd have to like look, I think take a harder look at the tracking data, but whether I could say that, but I will just say more generally and quickly that, you know, that is like that tends, and whether it's in Indian country, which is what I cover mostly for the New Republic, so you know, whether it's around tribal communities, whether it's around Black and Latinx communities, like this is where we see a lot of these things kind of concentrated. So I wouldn't be surprised, but again, I just have to check the data on that one.
Yeah, of course. But very, very diplomatic, but I would imagine in many instances, that is the reality, as you say. So Nick Martin, staff writer at the New Republic, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Appreciate you all having me. Have a great rest of your day.
You too.
That's it for another week of Ring of Fire. Hey, are you still subscribed to the free show? Well, head over to rofpodcast.com and hear what you've been missing. You become a member, you're getting our bonus material every week. And we're going to add to it too, going in the coming weeks. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And don't forget, you can check out my daily show, which is co-hosted by my colleague on this program, Emma Vigeland. Every day at noon, we stream live, and then it's later available as a podcast. For Emma Vigeland and Heather Parton, I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.